free of it. I wasn't cast out like the rest of you were. How can I yearn for something I never had? But I do. He sighed. Oh, I do. He looked around at Rosengarten, whose expression was uncomprehending. Look at him. The autarch glanced back at the captive as he spoke. He's got seconds left to live, but the leech gave him a taste and he wants it back again. A taste of what? Of the womb, Rosengarten. He said it was like being in the womb. We're all cast out. Whatever we build, wherever we hide, we're cast out. As he spoke, the prisoner gave a last, exhausted moan and lay still. The autarch watched the body a while, the only sound in the vastness of the chamber, the weakening motions of the leech on the cold floor. Lock the doors and seal them up, the autarch said, turning to leave without looking back at Rosengarten. I'm going to the pivot tower. Yes, sir. Come and find me when it's light. These nights, they're too long. Too long. I wonder, sometimes. But what he wondered had gone from his head before it could reach his lips, and when he left the lover's tomb, it was in silence. Chapter 36 1 Gentle's thoughts had not often turned to Taylor as he and Pi journeyed, but when, in the streets outside the palace, Nicetomas had asked him why he'd come to the Imagica, it had been Taylor's death he'd spoken of first, and only then of Judith, and the attempt upon her life. Now, as he and Nicetomas passed through the balmy, benighted courtyards and up into the palace itself, he thought of the man again, lying on his final pillow, talking about floating and charging Gentle to solve mysteries that he'd not had time to solve himself. I had a friend in the Fifth who would have loved this place, Gentle said. He loved desolation. It was here, in every courtyard. Gardens had been planted in many of them and left to riot, but riot took energy and nature was weary here, the plants throttling themselves after a few spurts and withering back into earth the colour of ash. The scene was not so different once they got inside, wandering mapless down galleries where the dust was as thick as the soil in the dead gardens, into forsaken annexes and chambers laid out for guests who had breathed their last decades before. Most of the walls, whether of chambers or galleries, were decorated, some with tapestries, many others with immense frescoes, and while there were scenes Gentle recognised from his travels, Parashokwa, under a green-gold sky with a flight of air balloons rising from the plain outside its walls, a festival at the Limbi temples, the suspicion grew on him that the finest of these images were of Earth, or, more particularly, of England. Doubtless the pastoral was a universal mode, and shepherds wooed nymphs in the reconciled dominions, just as sonnets described them doing in the Fifth. But there were details of these scenes that were indisputably English. Swallows swooping in mild summer skies, cattle drinking in water meadows while their herders slept, the Salisbury spire rising from a bank of oaks, the distant towers and domes of London, glimpsed from a slope on which maids and swains made dalliance. Even Stonehenge, relocated for drama's sake to a hill and set against thunderheads. England, Gentle said as they went, somebody here remembers England. Though they passed by these works too fast for him to scrutinise them carefully, he saw no signature on any. The artists who'd sketched England and returned to depict it so lovingly were apparently content to remain anonymous.
I think we should start climbing, Nicetomas suggested, when by chance their wanderings brought them to the foot of a monumental staircase. The higher we are, the more chance we'll have of grasping the geography.
The ascent was 5 flights long, more deserted galleries presenting themselves on every floor, but it finally delivered them onto a roof from which they were able to glimpse the scale of the labyrinth they were lost in. Towers 2 and 3 times the height of the one they climbed loomed above them, while below the courtyards were laid out in all directions, some crossed by battalions but most as deserted as every other corridor and chamber. Beyond them lay the palace walls, and beyond the walls themselves the smoke-shrouded city, the sound of its convulsions dim at such a distance.
Lulled by the remoteness of this eerie, both Gentle and Nicetomas were startled by a commotion that erupted much closer by. Almost grateful for signs of life in this mausoleum, even if it was the enemy, they headed in pursuit of the din-makers, back down a flight of stairs and across an enclosed bridge between towers.
"Hoods!"
Nicetomas said, tucking her ponytail back into her shirt and pulling the crude cowl over her head. Gentle did the same, though he doubted such a disguise would offer them much protection if they were discovered. Orders were being given in the gallery ahead, and Gentle drew Nicetomas into hiding to listen. The officer had words of inspiration for his squad, promising every man who brought a Yuhatemic down a month's paid leave. Somebody asked him how many there were, and he replied that he'd heard 6, but he didn't believe it because they'd slaughtered 10 times that number. "However many there are," he said, 6, 60, 600, they're outnumbered and trapped. They won't get out alive." So saying, he divided his contingent and told them to shoot on sight. 3 soldiers were dispatched in the direction of Nicetomas and Gentle's hiding place. They had no sooner passed than she stepped out of the shadows and brought 2 of the 3 down with single blows. The 3rd turned to defend himself, but Gentle, lacking the mass or muscle power that made Nicetomas so effective, used momentum instead, flinging himself against the man with such force he threw both of them to the ground. The soldier raised his gun towards Gentle's skull, but Nicetomas took hold of both weapon and hand, hauling the man up by his arm until he was head to head with her, the gun pointing at the roof, the fingers around it too crushed to fire. Then she pulled his helmet off with her free hand and peered at him.
"Where's the Ortak?"
The man was too pained and too terrified to claim ignorance.
"The Bivit Tower," he said.
"Which is where?"
"It's the tallest tower,"
he sobbed, scrabbling at the arm he was dangling by, down which blood was running.
"Take us there," Nicetomas said. "Please."
Teeth gritted, the man nodded his head, and she let him go. The gun went from his pulverized fingers as he struck the ground. She invited him to stand with a hooked finger.
"What's your name?"
she asked him.
"Yak Lazarevich,"
he told her, nursing his hand in the crook of his arm.
"Well, Yak Lazarevich, if you make any attempt, or I choose to interpret any act of yours as an attempt, to alert help, I will swat the brains from your pan so fast they'll be in Parashokwa before your pants fill. Is that plain?"
"That's plain."
"Do you have children?"
"Yes, I've got 2.
"Think of them fatherless, and take care. You have a question?"
"No. I just wanted to explain that the tower's quite away from here. I don't want you thinking I'm leading you astray."
"Be fast, then,"
she said. And Lazarevich took her at her word, leading them back across the bridge towards the stairs, explaining as he went that the quickest route to the tower was through the Sescordium, and that was 2 floors down. They had descended perhaps 12 steps when shots were fired behind them, and one of Lazarevich's 2 comrades staggered into view, adding shouts to his gunfire to raise the alarm. Had he not been groggy, he might have put a bullet in Nicetomas or Gentle, but they were away down the stairs before he'd even reached the top. Lazarevich protesting as he went that none of this was his doing, and he loved his children, and all he wanted to do was see them again. There was the sound of running in the lower gallery, and shouts answering those of the alarm raiser above. Nicetomas unleashed a series of expletives which could not have been fouler had Gentle understood them, and reached for Lazarevich, who haired off down the stairs before she could snatch hold of him, meeting a squad of his comrades at the bottom. Nicetomas's pursuit had taken her past Gentle directly into their line of fire. They didn't hesitate. 4 muzzles flared. 4 bullets found their mark. Her physique availed her nothing. She dropped where she stood, her body tumbling down the stairs and coming to a halt a few steps from the bottom. Watching her fall, 3 thoughts went through Gentle's head. 1, that he'd have these bastards for this. 2, that stealth was irrelevant now. And 3, that if he brought the roof down on their murderous heads and word spread that there was another power in the palace besides the Ortak, that would be no bad thing. He'd regretted the deaths he'd caused in Licorice Street, but he would not regret these. All he had to do was get his hand to his face to tear away the cloth before the bullets flew. There were more soldiers converging on the spot from several directions. "Come on," he thought, raising his hands in feigned surrender as the others approached. "Come on, join the Jubilee." One of the gathering number was clearly a man of authority. Heels clicked together as he appeared, salutes were exchanged. He looked up the staircase towards his hooded prisoner.
"General Rasidio," one of the captains said, "we have two of the rebels here."
"These aren't your Hatameks." His gaze went from Gentle to the body of Nicetomas, then back up to Gentle again. "I think we have two deathers here."
He started up the stairs towards Gentle, who was surreptitiously drawing breath through the open weave of the cloth around his face in preparation for his unveiling. He would have 2 or 3 seconds at best, time perhaps to seize Rasidio and use him as a hostage if the Numa failed to kill every one of the gunmen.
"Let's see what you look like," the commander said, and tore the cloth from Gentle's face.
The instant that should have seen the Numa loosed instead saw Rasidio drop back in stupefaction from the features he'd uncovered. Whatever he saw was missed by the soldiers below, who kept their guns trained on Gentle until Rasidio spat an order that they be lowered. Gentle was as confounded as they, but he wasn't about to question the reprieve. He dropped his hands and, stepping over the body of Nicetomas, came to the bottom of the stairs. Rasidio retreated further, shaking his head as he did so and wetting his lips, but apparently unable to find the words to express himself. He looked as though he was expecting the ground to open up beneath him, indeed was silently willing it to do so. Rather than risk disabusing the man of his error by speaking, Gentle summoned his guide Lazarevich forward with the hooked finger Nicetomas had used minutes before. The man had taken refuge behind a shield of soldiers and only came out of hiding reluctantly, glancing at his captain and Rasidio in the hope that Gentle's summons would be countermanded. It was not, however. Gentle went to meet him, and Rasidio uttered the first words he'd been able to find since setting eyes on the trespasser's face.
"Forgive me," he said. "I'm mortified."
Gentle didn't give him the solace of a response, but with Lazarevich at his side, took a step towards the knot of soldiers at the top of the next flight of stairs. They parted without a word, and he headed between their ranks, fighting the urge to pick up his pace, tempting though it was, and he regretted, too, not being able to say his farewells to Nicetomas. But neither impatience nor sentiment would profit him now. He'd been blessed, and maybe in the fullness of time he'd understand why. In the short term, he had to get to the Autarch and hope that the Mistiff was there also.
"You still want to go to the Pivot Tower?" Lazarevich said.
"Yes."
"When I get you there, will you let me go?"
Again he said,
"Yes."
There was a pause while Lazarevich oriented himself at the bottom of the stairs. Then he said,
"Who are you?"
"Wouldn't you like to know?" Gentle replied,
his answer as much for his own benefit as that of his guide. 2. There had been 6 of them at the start. Now there were 2. One of the casualties had been Thess Re'ot, shot down as he etched with a cross a corner they'd turned in the maze of courtyards. It had been his inspiration to mark their route and so facilitate a speedy exit when they'd finished their work.
"It's only the Autarch's will that holds these walls up," he'd said as they'd entered the palace. "Once he's down, they'll come too. We need to beat a quick retreat if we're not to get buried."
That Thess Re'ot had volunteered for a mission his laughter had dubbed fatal was surprising enough, but this further show of optimism teetered on the schizophrenic. His sudden death not only robbed Pi of an unlooked-for ally, but also of the chance to ask him why he'd joined the assault. But then several such conundrums had accrued around this endeavour, not least the sense of inevitability that had attended every phase, as though this judgment had been laid down long before Pi and Gentle had ever appeared in his Ordrex, and any attempt to flout it would defy the wisdom of greater magistrates than Culus. Such inevitability bred fatalism, of course, and though the Mistiff had encouraged Thess Re'ot to plot their route of return, it entertained few delusions about making that journey. It willfully kept from its mind the losses that extinction would bring until its remaining comrade, Luchur Kem, a purebred Yehotemic, his skin blue-black, his eyes double-irised, raised the subject. They were in a gallery lined with frescoes that evoked the city Pi had once called home, the painted streets of London, depicted as they'd been in the age into which the Mistiff had been born, replete with pigeon-hawkers, mummers, and dandies. Seeing the way Pi gazed at these sights, Luchur Kem said,
Never again, eh?
Never again what?
Out in the street, seeing the way the world is some morning.
No?
No, Luchurkem said. We're not coming back this way, and we both know it.
I don't mind, Pi replied. I've seen a lot of things. I felt even more. I've got no regrets.
You've had a long life?
Yes, I have.
And your maestro, he had a long life, too?
Yes, he did, Pi said,
looking again at the scenes on the walls. Though the renderings were relatively unsophisticated, they touched the mischief's memories awake, evoking the bustle and din of the crowded thoroughfares it and its maestro had walked in the bright, hopeful days before the reconciliation. Here were the fashionable streets of Mayfair, lined with fine shops and paraded by finer women, abroad by lavender water and Mantua silk and snow-white muslin. Here was the throng of Oxford Street, where half a hundred vendors clamoured for custom, purveyors of slippers, wildfowl, cherries and gingerbread, all vying for a niche on the pavement and a space in the air to raise their cries. Here, too, was a fair, St. Bartholomew's, most likely, where there was more sin to be had by daylight than Babylon ever boasted by dark.
Who made these? Pi wondered aloud as they proceeded.
Diverse hands, by the look of them, Luchurkem replied. You can see where one style stops and another starts.
But somebody directed these painters, gave them the details, the colours.
Unless the Autarch just stole artists from the Fifth Dominion. Perfectly possible, Luchurkem said. He stole architects. He put tribes in chains to build the place.
And nobody ever challenged him?
People tried to stir up revolutions over and over again, but he suppressed them, burned down the universities, hanged the theologians and the radicals. He had a stranglehold, and he had the pivot, and most people believe that's the Unbeheld's seal of approval. If Apexamendios didn't want the Autarch to rule his Orderex, why did he allow the pivot to be moved here? That's what they said. And I don't...
Luchurkem stopped in his tracks, seeing that Pi had already done so.
What is it?
He asked. The mischief stared up at the picture they had come abreast of, its breath quickened by shock.
Is something wrong? Luchurkem said.
It took a few moments to find the words.
I don't think we should go any further, it said.
Why not?
Not together, at least. The judgment fell on me, and I should finish this alone.
What's wrong with you? I've come this far. I want to have the satisfaction.
What's more important?
The mischief asked him, turning from the painting it had been so fixated by.
Your satisfaction? Or succeeding in what we came here to do?
You know my answer to that.
Then trust me. I have to go on alone. Wait for me here if you like.
Luchurkem made a phlegm-hawking growl, like Culus's growl, only coarser.
I came here to kill the Autarch, he said.
No, you came here to help me, and you've done that. It's my hands that have to dispatch him, not yours. That's the judgment.
Suddenly it's the judgment. The judgment! I shit on the judgment. I want to see the Autarch dead. I want to look on his face.
I'll bring you his eyes, Pi said. That's the best I can do. I mean it, Luchurkem. We have to part here.
Luchurkem spat on the ground between them.
You don't trust me, do you?
He said.
If that's what you want to believe.
Mischief shite, he exploded. If you come out of this alive, I'll kill you. I swear I'll kill you.
There was no further argument. He simply spat again and turned his back, stalking off down the gallery, leaving the mischief to return its gaze to the picture which had quickened its pulse and breath. Though it was curious to see a rendering of Oxford Street and St. Bartholomew's Fair in this setting, so far in years and dominions from the scene that had inspired them, Pi might have suppressed the suspicion growing in its belly while Luchurkem talked of revolution that this was no coincidence, had the final image in the cycle not been so unlike those that had preceded it. The rest had been public spectacles, rendered countless times in satirical prints and paintings. This last was not. The rest had been well-known sights and streets, famous across the world. This last was not. It was an unremarkable thoroughfare in Clerkenwell,
almost a backwater, which Pye doubted any artist of the Fifth had ever turned his pen or brush to depicting. But here it was, represented in meticulous detail, Gamut Street, to the brick, to the leaf, and taking pride of place in the centre of the picture, number 28, the Maestro Sartori's house. It had been lovingly recreated. Birds quartered on its roof, on its step dogs fought, and in between the fighters and wooers stood the house itself, blessed by a dappled sunlight denied the others in the row. The front door was closed, but the upper windows were flung wide, and the artist had painted somebody watching from one of them, his face too deeply shadowed to be recognized. The object of his scrutiny was not in doubt, however, the girl in the window across the street, sitting at her mirror with her dog on her lap, her fingers teasing from its bow the ribbon that would presently unlace her bodice. In the street between this beauty and her doting voyeur were a dozen details that could only have come from first-hand experience. On the pavement, beneath the girl's window, a small procession of charity children passed, wards of the parish dressed all in white and carrying their wands. They marched raggedly behind their beadle, a brute of a man called Willis, whom Sartori had once beaten senseless on that very spot for cruelty to his charges. Around the far corner came Roxburgh's carriage, drawn by his favourite bay, Bellamar, named in honour of the Comte de Saint-Germain, who had swindled half the women of Venice under that alias a few years before. A dragoon was being ushered out of number 32 by the mistress of that house, who entertained officers of the Prince of Wales regiment, the 10th and no other, whenever her husband was away. The widow opposite watched enviously from her step. All these and a dozen other little dramas were being played out in the picture, and there wasn't one Pye didn't remember seeing enacted countless times. But who was the unseen spectator who'd instructed the painters in their craft, so that carriage, girl, soldier, widow, dogs, birds, voyeurs, and all could be set down with such verisimilitude? Having no solution to the puzzle, the mistiff plucked its gaze from the picture and looked back along the immense length of the gallery. Luchur Kem had disappeared, spitting as he went. The mistiff was alone, the roots ahead and behind similarly deserted. It would miss Luchur Kem's companionship and bitterly regretted that it had lacked the wit to persuade its comrade that it had to go on alone, without causing such offence. But the picture on the wall was proof of secrets here it had not yet fathomed, and when it did so it wanted no witnesses. They too easily became accusers, and Pye was weighed down with enough reproaches already. If the tyrannies of his Orderex were in some fashion linked with a house on Gamut Street, and if Pye, by extension, was an unwitting collaborator in those tyrannies, it was important to learn of this guilt unaccompanied. As prepared as possible for such revelations, the mistiff left its place in front of the painting, reminding itself as it went of the promise made to Luchur Kem. If it survived this enterprise, it had to return with the eyes of the autarch, eyes which it now didn't doubt had once been laid on Gamut Street, studying it as obsessively as the watcher at the painted window studied his lady love, sitting across the street, in thrall to her reflection. Book 2. The Reconciliation. Chapter 1. Like the theatre districts of so many great cities across the Imagica, whether in reconciled dominions or in the Fifth, the neighbourhood in which the Ipse stood had been a place of some notoriety in earlier times, when actors of both sexes had supplemented their wages with the old five-actor, hiring, retiring, seduction, conjunction, and remittance, all played hourly, night and day. The centre of these activities had moved away, however, to the other side of the city, where the burgeoning numbers of middle-class clients felt less exposed to the gaze of their peers out seeking more respectable entertainment. Licorice Street and its environs had sprung up in a matter of months, and quickly became the third richest Kesperit in the city, leaving the theatre district to decline into legitimacy. Perhaps because it was of so little interest to people it had survived the traumas of the last few hours better than most Kesperits its size. It had seen some action. General Matalaus's battalions had passed through its streets going south to the causeway, where rebels were attempting to build a makeshift bridge across the delta. And later, a party of families from the Karames had taken refuge in Kobakovi's Rialto. But no barricades had been erected,
and none of the buildings burned. The deliquium would meet the morning intact. Its survival, however, would not be accorded to general disinterest, rather to the presence at its perimeter of Pale Hill, a sight which was neither a hill nor pale, but a circle of remembrance in the centre of which lay a well, used from time immemorial as a repository for the corpses of executed men, suicides, paupers, and, on occasion, romantics who favoured rotting in such company. Tomorrow's rumours would whisper that the ghosts of these forsaken souls had risen to defend their terrain, preventing the vandals and the barricade builders from destroying the Kesperat by haunting the steps of the Ipse and the Rialto and howling in the streets like dogs maddened from chasing the comet's tail. With her clothes in rags and her throat uttering one seamless supplication, Quasar went through the heart of several battles quite unscathed. There were many such grief-stricken women on the streets of Isordrex tonight, all begging Hapexamendios to return children or husbands into their arms, and they were for the most part given passage through the lines, their sobs password enough. The battles themselves didn't distress her. She'd organized and viewed mass executions in her time, but when the heads had rolled she'd always made a swift departure, leaving the aftermath for somebody else to shovel up. Now she had to tread, barefoot, in streets that were like abattoirs, and her legendary indifference to the spectacle of death was overtaken by a horror so profound she had several times changed her direction to avoid a street that stank too strongly of innards and burned blood. She knew she would have to confess this cowardice when she finally found the Man of Sorrows, but she was so laden with guilt that one more fault or less would scarcely matter. Then, as she came to the corner of the street at the end of which lay Plutharo Quexos's playhouse, somebody called her name. She stopped and looked for her summoner. A man dressed in blue was rising from a doorstep, the fruit he'd been peeling in one hand, the peeling blade in the other. He seemed to be in no doubt as to her identity.
"You're his woman," he said.
Was this the Lord? She wondered. The man she'd seen on the rooftops at the harbour had been silhouetted against a bright sky. His features had been difficult to see. Could this be him? He was calling someone from the interior of the house on the steps of which he'd been sitting, a sometime bordello to judge by its lewdly carved portico. The disciple, an ethac, emerged with a bottle in one hand, the other ruffling the hair of a cretinous boy-child, naked and glistening. She began to doubt her first judgment, but she didn't dare leave until she had her hopes confirmed or dashed.
"Are you the Man of Sorrows?" she said.
The fruit-peeler shrugged.
"Isn't everybody tonight?"
he said, tossing the uneaten fruit away. The cretin leapt down the steps and snatched it up, pushing the entire thing into his mouth so that his face bulged and the juice ran from his lips.
"You're the cause of this,"
the peeler said, jabbing his knife in Quasar's direction. He glanced around at the ethac.
"She was at the harbour. I saw her."
"Who is she?"
the ethac said.
"The Autarch's woman,"
came the reply.
"Quasar."
He took a step towards her.
"You are, aren't you?"
She could no more deny this than she could take flight. If this man was indeed Jesu, she couldn't begin her pleas for forgiveness with a lie.
"Yes," she told him, "I'm Quasar. I was the Autarch's woman."
"She's fucking beautiful," the ethac said. "What she looks like doesn't matter," the fruit peeler told him. "It's what she's done that's important."
"Yes,"
Quasar said, daring to believe now that this was indeed the son of David.
"That's what's important. What I've done."
"The executions."
"Yes."
"The purges."
"Yes."
"I've lost a lot of friends, and you're the reason."
"Oh, Lord, forgive me,"
she said, and dropped to her knees.
"I saw you at the harbour this morning,"
Jesus said, approaching her as she knelt.
"You were smiling."
"Forgive me."
"Looking around and smiling, and I thought when I saw you."
He was 3 paces away from her now.
"Your eyes glittering."
His sticky hand took hold of her head.
"I thought those eyes,"
he raised the knife,
"have to go,"
and brought it down again, quick and sharp, sharp and quick, pricking out his disciple's sight before she could start to scream. The tears that suddenly filled Jude's eyes stung like no tears she'd ever shed before.
She let out a sob, more of pain than of grief, pushing the heels of her hands against her eye sockets to stem the flow, but it wouldn't cease. The tears kept coming, hot and harsh, making her whole head throb. She felt Dowd's arm take hold of hers and was glad of it. Without his support, she was certain she would have fallen.
"What's wrong?" he said.
The answer, that she was sharing some agony with Quasar, was not one she could voice to Dowd.
"It must be the smoke," she said. "I can barely see."
"We're almost at the Ipse," he replied, "but we have to keep moving for a little while longer. It's not safe in the open air."
That was true enough. Her eyes, which at present could only see pulsing red, had been laid on enough atrocities in the last hour to fuel a lifetime of nightmares. The Azorderex of her longings, the city whose spicy wind blowing from the retreat months before had summoned her like the call of a lover to bed, was virtually in ruins. Perhaps that was why Quasar wept these burning tears. They dried after a time, but the pain lingered. Though she despised the man she was leaning upon, without his support she would have dropped to the ground and remained there. He coaxed her on, step by step. The Ipse was close now, he said, just a street or two away. She could rest there while he soaked up the echoes of past glories. She barely attended to his monologue. It was her sister who filled her thoughts, her anticipation of their meeting now tinged with unease. She'd imagined Quasar would have come into these streets protected, and that at the sight of her Dowd would simply retreat, leaving them to their reunion. But what if Dowd was not overtaken by superstitious awe? What if, instead, he attacked one or both of them? Would Quasar have any defense against his mites? She began to wipe at her streaming eyes as she stumbled on, determined to be clear-sighted when the moment came, and primed to escape Dowd's leash. His monologue, when it ceased, did so abruptly. He halted, drawing Jude to a stop at his side. She raised her head. The street ahead was not well lit, but the glow of distant fires found its way between the buildings, and there, crawling into one such flickering shaft, she saw her sister. Jude let out a sob. Quasar's eyes had been stabbed out, and her torturers were coming in pursuit of her. One was a child, one an Ethak. The third, the most blood-spattered, was also the most nearly human, but his features were twisted out of true by the pleasure he was taking in Quasar's torment. The blinding knife was still in his hand, and now he raised it above his victim's naked back. Before Dowd could move to stop her, Jude screamed, "Stop!" The knife was arrested in mid-descent, and all three of Quasar's pursuers looked around at Jude. The child registered nothing. Its face was an imbecilic blank. The knife-wielder was equally silent, though his expression was one of disbelief. It was the Ethak that spoke. The words he uttered slurred, but ripe with panic.
"You keep your distance,"
he said, his fearful glance going back and forth between the wounded woman and this echo of her, whole and strong. The blinder found his voice now and began to hush him, but the Ethak rattled on.
"Look at her," he said. "What the fuck is this, eh? Look at her!"
"Just shut your trap," the blinder said. "She's not going to touch us."
"You don't know that,"
said the Ethak, picking up the child with one arm and slinging it over his shoulder.
"It wasn't me," he went on as he backed away. "I never laid a finger on her, I swear. On my scars, I swear."
Jude ignored his weaselings and took a step towards Quasar. As soon as she moved, the Ethak fled. The blinder, however, held his ground, taking courage from his blade.
"I'll do you the same way," he warned. "I don't care who the fuck you are. I'll do you."
From behind her, Jude heard Dowd's voice, carrying an authority she'd never heard in it before.
"I'd leave her be if I were you," he said.
His utterance brought a response from Quasar. She raised her head and turned in Dowd's direction. Her eyes had not simply been stabbed out, but virtually dug from their sockets. Seeing the holes, Jude was ashamed to have been so troubled by the little ache that she felt in sympathy. It was nothing beside Quasar's hurt. Yet the woman's voice was almost joyful.
"Lord," she said, "sweet Lord, is this punishment enough? Will you forgive me now?"
Neither the nature of the error Quasar was making here nor its profound irony was lost on Jude. Dowd was no saviour. But he was happy enough to assume that role, it seemed. He replied to Quaiswa with a delicacy as feigned as the sonority he'd affected seconds before.
"Of course I'll forgive you," he said. "That's what I'm here to do."
Jude might have been tempted to disabuse Quaiswa of her illusions there and then, but that the blinder was usefully distracted by Dowd's performance.
"Tell me who you are, child," Dowd said.
"You know who the fuck she is,"
the blinder spat.
"Quaiswa! It's fucking Quaiswar!"
Dowd glanced back at Jude, his expression one of comprehension rather than shock. Then he looked again at the blinder.
"So it is," he said.
"You know what she's done, same as me," the man said. "She deserves worse than this."
"Worse, you think?" Dowd said, continuing to advance towards the man, who was nervously passing his knife from hand to hand, as though he sensed that Dowd's capacity for cruelty outstripped his own 100-fold, and was preparing to defend himself if need be.
"What worse would you do?" Dowd said.
"What she's done to others, over and over."
"She did these things personally, you think?"
"I wouldn't put it past her,"
he said. "Who knows what the fuck goes on up there? People disappear and get washed up again in pieces."
He tried a little smile, plainly nervous now.
"You know she deserved it."
"And you?" Dowd asked. "What do you deserve?" "I'm not saying I'm a hero," the blinder replied. "I'm just saying she had it coming."
"I see," said Dowd. From Dude's vantage point, what happened next was more a matter of conjecture than observation. She saw Quaiswa's maimer take a step away from Dowd, repugnance on his face, then saw him lunge forward as if to stab Dowd through the heart. His attack put him in range of the mites, and before his blade could find Dowd's flesh, they must have leapt at the blinder, because he dropped back with a shout of horror, his free hand going up to his face. Jude had seen what followed before. The man scrabbled at his eyes and nostrils and mouth, his legs giving out beneath him as the mites undid his system from the inside. He fell at Dowd's feet and rolled around in a fury of frustration, eventually putting his knife into his mouth and digging bloodily for the things that were unmaking him. The life went out of him as he was doing so, his hand dropping from his face, leaving the blade in his throat as though he'd choked upon it.
"It's over," Dowd said to Quaiswa, who had wrapped her arms around her shuddering body and was lying on the ground a few yards from her tormentor's corpse. "He won't hurt you again."
"Thank you, Lord."
"The things he accused you of, child?"
"Yes."
"Terrible things?"
"Yes."
"Are you guilty of them?"
"I am," Quaiswa said. "I want to confess them before I die. Will you hear me?"
"I will," Dowd said, oozing magnanimity.
After being merely a witness to these events as they unravelled, Jude now stepped towards Quaiswa and her confessor, but Dowd heard her approach and turned to shake his head.
"I've sinned, my Lord Jesu," Quaiswa was saying. "I've sinned so many times. I beg you to forgive me."
It was the despair Jude heard in her sister's voice, rather than Dowd's rebuff, that kept her from making her presence known. Quaiswa was in extremis, and given that it was her clear desire to commune with some forgiving spirit, what right did Jude have to intervene? Dowd was not the Christ Quaiswa believed him to be, but did that matter? What would revealing the father confessor's true identity achieve now, besides adding to the sum of her sister's suffering? Dowd had knelt beside Quaiswa and taken her up into his arms, demonstrating a capacity for tenderness, or at least for its replication, that Jude would never have believed him capable of. For her part, Quaiswa was in bliss, despite her wounds. She clutched at Dowd's jacket and thanked him over and over for doing her this kindness. He hushed her softly, saying there was no need for her to make a catalogue of her crimes.
"You have them in your heart, and I see them there," he said. "I forgive them. Tell me instead about your husband. Where is he? Why hasn't he also come asking for forgiveness?"
"He didn't believe you were here," Quaiswa said. "I told him I'd seen you down at the harbour.
But he has no faith.
None?
Only in himself, she said bitterly. Dowd began to rock backward and forward as he plied her with further questions, his focus so devoted to his victim he didn't notice Jude's approach. She envied Dowd his embrace, wishing it were her arms Quasar was lying in instead of his.
Who is your husband? Dowd was asking.
You know who he is, Quasar replied. He's the Autarch. He rules the Imagicka.
But he wasn't always Autarch, was he?
No.
So what was he before? Dowd wanted to know. An ordinary man?
No, she said. I don't think he was ever an ordinary man. I don't remember exactly.
He stopped rocking her.
I think you do, he said, his tone subtly shifting. Tell me, he said. Tell me, what was he before he ruled Isordarax? And what were you?
I was nothing, she said simply.
Then how were you raised so high?
He loved me. From the very beginning he loved me.
You did no unholy service to be elevated, Dowd said.
She hesitated and he pressed her harder.
What did you do? He demanded. What? What?
There was a distant echo of Oscar in that expletive, the servant speaking with his master's voice. Intimidated by this fury, Quasar replied,
I visited the bastion of the Banu many times, she confessed, even the annex. I went there, too.
And what's there?
Mad women. Some who killed their spouses or their children.
Why do you seek such pitiful creatures out?
There are powers hidden among them.
At this, Jude attended more closely than ever.
What kind of powers?
Dowd said, voicing the question she was silently asking.
I did nothing unholy, Quasar protested. I just wanted to be cleansed. The pivot was in my dreams. Every night its shadow on me, breaking my back. I only wanted to be cleansed of it.
And were you?
Dowd asked her. Again she didn't answer at first, until he pressed her, almost harshly.
Were you?
I wasn't cleansed. I was changed, she said. The women polluted me. I have a taint in my flesh, and I wish it were out of me.
She began to tear at her clothes, till her fingers found her belly and breasts.
I want it driven out, she said. It gave me new dreams, worse than before.
Calm yourself, Dowd said.
But I want it out! I want it out!
A kind of fit had suddenly taken her, and she flailed so violently in his arms she fell from them.
I can feel it in me now,
she said, her nails raking her breasts. Jude looked at Dowd, willing him to intervene. But he simply stood up, staring at the woman's distress, plainly taking pleasure in it. Quasar's self-assault was not theatrics. She was drawing blood from her skin, still yelling that she wanted the taint out of her. In her agony, a subtle change was coming over her flesh, as though she was sweating out the taint she'd spoken of. Her pores were oozing a sheen of iridescence, and the cells of her skin were subtly changing colour. Jude knew the blue she saw spreading from her sister's neck, down over her body and up towards her contorted face. It was the blue of the stone eye, the blue of the goddess.
What is this?
Dowd demanded of his confessee.
Out of me! Out of me!
Is this the taint?
He went down on his haunches beside her.
Is it?
Drive it out of me!
Quasar sobbed and began assaulting her poor body afresh. Jude could endure it no longer. Allowing her sister to die blissfully in the arms of a surrogate divinity was one thing. This self-mutilation was quite another. She broke her vow of silence.
Stop her,
she said. Dowd looked up from his study, drawing his thumb across his throat to hush her. But it was too late. Despite her own commotion, Quasar had heard her sister speak. Her thrashings slowed, and her blind head turned in Jude's direction.
Who's there?
She demanded. There was naked fury on Dowd's face, but he hushed her softly. She would not be placated, however.
Who's with you, Lord?
She asked him. With his reply, he made an error that unknitted the whole fiction.
He lied to her.
"There's nobody," he said.
"I heard a woman's voice. Who's there?"
"I told you," Dowd insisted. "Nobody."
He put his hand upon her face. "Now calm yourself. We're alone."
"No, we're not."
"Do you doubt me, child?"
Dowd replied, his voice, after the harshness of his last interrogations, modulating with this question so that he sounded almost wounded by her lack of faith. Quaiswa's reply was to silently take his hand from her face, seizing it tightly in her blue, blood-speckled fingers.
"That's better," he said.
Quaiswa ran her fingers over his palm. Then she said,
"No scars."
"There'll always be scars,"
Dowd said, lavishing his best pontifical manner upon her, but he'd missed the point of her remark.
"There are no scars on your hand," she said.
He retrieved it from her grasp.
"Believe in me," he said.
"No," she replied. "You're not the man of sorrows."
The joy had gone from her voice. It was thick, almost threatening.
"You can't save me,"
she said, suddenly flailing wildly to drive the pretender from her.
"Where's my saviour? I want my saviour."
"He isn't here," Jude told her.
"He never was."
Quaiswa turned in Jude's direction.
"Who are you?"
she said.
"I know your voice from somewhere."
"Keep your mouth shut,"
Dowd said, stabbing his finger in Jude's direction.
"Or so help me, you'll taste the mites."
"Don't be afraid of him," Quaiswa said.
"She knows better than that," Dowd replied. "She's seen what I can do."
Eager for some excuse to speak so that Quaiswa could hear more of the voice she knew but couldn't yet name, Jude spoke up in support of Dowd's conceit.
"What he says is right,"
she told Quaiswa.
"He can hurt us both, badly. He's not the man of sorrows, sister."
Whether it was the repetition of words Quaiswa had herself used several times, man of sorrows, or the fact that Jude had called her sister, or both, the woman's sightless face slackened, the bafflement going out of it. She lifted herself from the ground.
"What's your name?" she murmured. "Tell me your name."
"She's nothing,"
Dowd said, echoing Quaiswa's own description of herself minutes earlier.
"She's a dead woman."
He made a move in Jude's direction.
"You understand so little," he said, "and I've forgiven you a lot for that. But I can't indulge you any longer. You've spoiled a fine game. I don't want you spoiling any more."
He put his left hand, its forefinger extended, to his lips.
"I don't have many mites left," he said, "so one will have to do. A slow unravelling, but even a shadow like you can be undone."
"I'm a shadow now, am I?" Jude said to him. "I thought we were the same, you and I. Remember that speech?"
"That was in another life, lovey," Dowd said. "It's different here. You could do me harm here. So I'm afraid it's going to have to be thank you and good night."
She started to back away from him, wondering as she did so how much distance she would have to put between them to be out of range of his wretched mites. He watched her retreat with pity on his face.
"No good, lovey," he said. "I know these streets like the back of my hand."
She ignored his condescension and took another backward step, her eye fixed on his mouth where the mites nested, but aware that Quaiswa had risen and was standing no more than a yard from her defender.
"Sister?"
the woman said. Dowd glanced around, distracted from Jude long enough for her to take to her heels. He let out a shout as she fled, and the blind woman lunged towards the sound, grabbing his arm and neck and dragging him towards her. The noise she made as she did so was like nothing Jude had heard from human lips, and she envied it. A cry to shatter bones like glass and shake colour from the air. She was glad not to be closer, or it might have brought her to her knees. She looked back once in time to see Dowd spit the lethal mite at Quaiswa's empty sockets, and prayed her sister had better defences against its harm than the man who'd emptied them. Whether or no, she could do little to help. Better to run while she had the chance, so that at least one of them survived the cataclysm. She turned the first corner she came to, and kept turning corners thereafter to put as many decisions between herself and her pursuer. No doubt Dowd's boast was true. He did indeed know these streets, where he claimed he'd once triumphed, like his own hand. It followed that the sooner she was out of them and into terrain unfamiliar to them both, the more chance she had of losing him. Until then, she had to be swift and as nearly invisible as she could make herself. Like the shadow Dowd had dubbed her, darkness in a deeper dark, flitting and fleeting, seen and gone. But her body didn't want to oblige. It was weary, beset with aches and shudders. Twin fires had been set in her chest, one in each lung. Invisible hounds ripped her heels bloody. She didn't allow herself to slow her pace, however, until she'd left the streets of playhouses and brothels behind her and was delivered into a place that might have stood as a set for a Pleuthero Quexos tragedy, a circle 100 yards wide, bounded by a high wall of sleek, black stone. The fires that burned here didn't rage uncontrolled, as they did in so many other parts of the city, but flickered from the tops of the walls in their dozens. Tiny white flames, like nightlights, illuminating the inclined pavement that led down to an opening in the centre of the circle. She could only guess at its function. An entrance into the city's secret underworld, perhaps. Or a well. There were flowers everywhere, most of the petals shed and gone to rot, slickening the pavement beneath her feet as she approached the hole, obliging her to tread with care. The suspicion grew that if this was a well, its water was poisoned with the dead. Obituaries were scrawled on the pavement, names, dates, messages, even crude illustrations, their numbers increasing the closer to the edge she came. Some had even been inscribed on the inner wall of the well by mourners brave or broken-hearted enough to dare the drop. Although the hole exercised the same fascination as a cliff edge, inviting her to peer into its depths, she refused its petitions and halted a yard or two from the lip. There was a sickly smell out of the place, though it wasn't strong. Either the well had not been used of late, or else its occupants lay a very long way down. Her curiosity satisfied, she looked around to choose the best route out. There were no less than 8 exits, 9 including the well, and she went first to the avenue that lay opposite the one she'd come in by. It was dark and smoky, but she might have taken it had there not been signs that it was blocked by rubble some way down its length. She went to the next, and it too was blocked, fires flickering between fallen timbers. She was going to the third door when she heard Dowd's voice. She turned. He was standing on the far side of the well, with his head slightly cocked and a put-upon expression on his face, like a parent who'd caught up with a truant child.
"Didn't I tell you?" he said. "I know these streets."
"I heard you."
"It isn't so bad that you came here," he said, wandering towards her. "It saves me a mite."
"Why do you want to hurt me?" she said.
"I might ask you the same question," she said. "You do, don't you? You'd love to see me hurt. You'd be even happier if you could do the hurting personally. Admit it."
"I admit it."
"There. Don't I make a good confessor after all? And that's just the beginning. You've got some secrets in you I didn't even know you had."
He raised his hand and described a circle as he spoke.
"I begin to see the perfection of all this. Things coming round, back to the place where it all began. That is, to her. Or to you. It doesn't matter, really. You're the same."
"Twins," Jude said. "Is that it?"
"Nothing so trite, lovey. Nothing so natural. I insulted you, calling you a shadow. You're more miraculous than that. You're..."
He stopped.
"Well, wait. This isn't strictly fair. Here's me telling you what I know and getting nothing from you."
"I don't know anything," Jude said. "I wish I did."
Dowd stooped and picked up a blossom, one of the few underfoot that was still intact.
"But whatever Quasar knows, you also know," he said, "at least about how it all came apart."
"How what came apart?"
"The reconciliation. You were there. Oh yes, I know you think you're just an innocent bystander, but there's nobody in this, nobody who's innocent. Not Esterbrook, not Godolphin, not Gentle or his mischief. They've all got confessions as long as their arms."
"Even you?" she asked him.
"Ah,
Well, with me it's different, he sighed, sniffing at the flower. I'm an actor, Chappie. I fake my raptures. I'd like to change the world, but I end up as entertainment. Whereas all you lovers, he spoke the word contemptuously, who couldn't give a fuck about the world as long as you're feeling passionate, you're the ones who make the cities burn and the nations tumble. You're the engines in the tragedy, and most of the time you don't even know it. So what's an actor Chappie to do if he wants to be taken seriously? I'll tell you. He has to learn to fake his feelings so well, he'll be allowed off the stage and into the real world. It's taken me a lot of rehearsal to get where I am, believe me. I started small, you know, very small. Messenger, spear carrier. I once pimped for the unbeheld, but it was just a one-night stand. Then I was back serving lovers.
Like Oscar.
Like Oscar. You hated him, didn't you? No, I was simply bored. With him and his whole family. He was so like his father, and his father's father, and so on, all the way back to crazy Joshua. I became impatient. I knew things would come around eventually, and I'd have my moment, but I got so tired of waiting, and once in a while I let it show.
And you plotted.
But of course, I wanted to hurry things along, towards the moment of my emancipation. It was all very calculated. But that's me, you see. I'm an artist with the soul of an accountant.
Did you hire Pi to kill me?
Not knowingly, Dowd said. I set some wheels in motion, but I never imagined they'd carry us all so far. I didn't even know the Mistiff was alive. But as things went on, I began to see how inevitable all this was. First Pi's appearance. Then you're meeting Godolphin, and you're falling for each other. It was all bound to happen. It was what you were born to do, after all. Do you miss him, by the way? Tell the truth.
I've scarcely thought about him, she replied, surprised by the truth of this.
Out of sight, out of mind, eh? Ah, I'm so glad I can't feel love. The misery of it, the sheer unadulterated misery.
He mused a moment, then said, This is so much like the first time, you know.
Lovers yearning, worlds trembling. Of course, last time I was merely a spear carrier. This time I intend to be the prince.
What do you mean, I was born to fall for Godolphin? I don't even remember being born.
I think it's time you did, Dowd said, tossing away the flower as he approached her. Though these rites of passage are never very easy, lovey, so brace yourself. At least you've picked a good spot. We can dangle our feet over the edge while we talk about how you came into the world.
Oh, no, she said. I'm not going near that hole.
You think I want to kill you? He said. I don't. I just want you to unburden yourself of a few memories. That's not asking too much, is it? Be fair. I've given you a glimpse of what's in my heart. Now show me yours.
He took hold of her wrist.
I won't take no for an answer, he said, and drew her to the edge of the well.
She'd not ventured this close before, and its proximity was vertiginous. Though she cursed him for having the strength to drag her here, she was glad he had her in a tight hold.
Do you want to sit? He said.
She shook her head.
As you like, he went on. There's more chance of your falling, but it's your decision. You've become a very self-willed woman, lovey, I've noticed that. You were malleable enough at the beginning. That was the way you were bred to be, of course.
I wasn't bred to be anything.
How do you know? He said. 2 minutes ago you were claiming you don't even remember the past. How do you know what you were meant to be, made to be?
He glanced down the well.
The memory's in your head somewhere, lovey. You just have to be willing to coax it out. If Quasar sought some goddess, maybe you did too, even if you don't remember it. And if you did, then maybe you're more than Joshua's peach plum. Maybe you've got some place in the action I haven't accounted for.
Where would I meet goddesses, Dowd? Jude replied. I've lived in the Fifth, in London, in Notting Hill Gate. There are no goddesses.
Even as she spoke, she thought of Celestine, buried beneath the Tabula Rasa's tower. Was she a sister to the deities that haunted Isorderex?
a transforming force, locked away by a sex that worshipped fixedness? At the memory of the prisoner and her cell, Jude's mind grew suddenly light, as though she'd downed a whiskey on an empty stomach. She had been touched by the miraculous, after all. So if once, why not many times? If now, why not in her forgotten past?
"I've got no way back," she said,
protesting the difficulty of this as much for her own benefit as Dowd's.
"It's easy," he replied.
"Just think of what it was like to be born. I don't even remember my childhood."
"You had no childhood, Lovey. You had no adolescence. You were born just the way you are overnight. Quasar was the first Judith, and you, my sweet, are only her replica. Perfect, maybe, but still a replica."
I don't believe you."
"Of course you must refuse the truth at first. It's perfectly understandable. But your body knows what's true and what isn't. You're shaking, inside and out."
"I'm tired," she said,
knowing the explanation was pitifully weak.
"You're feeling more than weary," Dowd said. "Admit it."
As he pried, she remembered the results of his last revelations about her past, how she'd dropped to the kitchen floor, hamstrung by invisible knives. She dared not succumb to such a collapse now, with the well a foot from where she stood, and Dowd knew it.
"You have to face the memories," he was saying. "Just spit them out. Go on. You'll feel better for it, I promise you."
She could feel both her limbs and her resolve weakening as he spoke. But the prospect of facing whatever lay in the darkness at the back of her skull, and however much she distrusted Dowd, she didn't doubt there was something horrendous there, was almost as terrifying as the thought of the well taking her. Perhaps it would be better to die here and now, two sisters extinguished within the same hour, and never know whether Dowd's claims were true or not. But then suppose he'd been lying to her all along, the actor Chappie's finest performance yet, and she was not a shadow, not a replica, not a thing bred to do service, but a natural child with natural parents, a creature unto herself, real, complete. Then she'd be giving herself to death out of fear of self-discovery, and Dowd would have claimed another victim. The only way to defeat him was to call his bluff, to do as he kept urging her to do and go into the darkness at the back of her head, ready to embrace whatever revelations it concealed. Whichever Judith she was, she was. Whether real or replica, natural or bred. There was no escape from herself in the living world. Better to know the truth, once and for all. The decision ignited a flame in her skull, and the first phantoms of the past appeared in her mind's eye.
"Oh, my goddess," she murmured, throwing back her head. "What is this? What is this?"
She saw herself lying on bare boards, in an empty room, a fire burning in the grate, warming her in her sleep and flattering her nakedness with its lustre. Somebody had marked her body while she slept, daubing upon it a design she recognized, the glyph she'd first seen in her mind's eye when she'd made love with Oscar, then glimpsed again as she passed between dominions, the spiralling sign of her flesh, here painted on flesh itself in half a dozen colours. She moved in her sleep, and the whorls seemed to leave traces of themselves in the air where she'd been, their persistence exciting another motion, this other in the ring of sand that bounded her hard bed. It rose around her like the curtain of the Borealis, shimmering with the same colours in which her glyph had been painted, as though something of her essential anatomy was in the very air of the room. She was entranced by the beauty of the sight.
"What are you seeing?" she heard Dowd asking her.
"Me,"